Blog Talk Radio.
Coach Marcia here. Well, I'm manning everything alone tonight because my partner in crime is off doing a college planning seminar. And for those of you who don't know, Jim is a financial planner, but he's also a college planner. And he's also a relationship coach like me. He just deals with the numbers and I deal with the behavior. I'm glad you're here with me tonight, though. It is 6:32 p.m. It's 78 degrees here in the 44109. The little icon says it's sunshine, but trust me, a storm is on the way. This would make just about a week full of storms here. We had seriously rough weather last night. A storm came up about almost about 6 o'clock and lasted pretty much well into the night. Some areas had lots of hail and torrential downpour, as I like to call it, and thunder and lightning and the whole ballywick. Of course, I think a little bit, I'm not good with directions, but I think a little bit north of here, a tornado touched down briefly. But fortunately, I think all the damage was confined to a barn. So we're thankful for that. But like I said, another storm is on the way. So if all of a sudden you hear me talking and then all of a sudden you hear quiet, you'll know that I got bounced off the internet. And that has happened several times today because the storms are in the area. And, of course, we have voiceover IP, which is how we come to you live on Mondays and Thursdays. So hang in there. If I get disconnected, I'll call back in and we'll do the best that we can to go from there. I want to tell you a little bit before I do gym stuff on sports. I want to tell you a little bit about our guest tonight. We have author Rebecca Fisher, who is a school teacher and wrote a book about all the wrong thing, all the wrong places. And I don't think there's anybody within the listening audience who hasn't felt like they were or have been in all the wrong places at one time or another. At the 7:30 segment, Allison Manswell will be on, and she's going to tell us an amazing story about how she found her biological father, who turned out to be a Ghanaian doctor, and she had never met after looking for him for 21 years. At 7:40, Dr. William Porter is going to come on, and he's going to discuss a problem that affects a lot of women that a lot of men don't know about. And some of the assumptions and presumptions about intimacy that men have and about women making excuses may not be as far-fetched as you think, but it's an issue, like I said. It's a women's issue that affects men as well. So he'll be on at 7:40. In the meantime, we got to talk baseball. If Jim was here, he'd be, you know, sort of leaping out of his chair because our Cleveland Indians have an amazing record. They are 30-17, and even though they got beat up on pretty good by the Bo Sox last night, they have one of the best records, if not the best record in baseball. So we're all excited because after having a terrible football team and an even worse basketball team, all of a sudden, our baseball team emerges victorious, and so We're very supportive of them, and we're very happy to see them in first, solidly in first place. Most of you hear me talk about my friend EJ in Philadelphia. And right now, the Phillies and the Indians have the best records in baseball in the American League and the National League. And it was very interesting because the Phillies were locked in a six-hour and 11-minute battle last night, and it was a battle for a score. But Cliff Lee drove in three runs to lift the Phillies over the Reds. And like I said, the game lasted 6 hours and 11 minutes and 19 innings. So my question at this point is, should Major League Baseball have a 7-inning stretch, a 14-inning stretch, and a 21-inning stretch? Because the Indians have gone games that have gone 21 innings, as have some other teams. Also, this season, there have been a record number of extra-inning games so far. And so far they've only played, I guess this is like not even near the halfway point yet. So the season is rolling along, and so are those innings. And the funny thing is, the Phillies played the worst kind of game where you have a game that extends well into the night, and then you have to come back and play a day game. And they won the day game, too. They beat the Bo Sox 10-4, so that was a convincing win for them. So way to go, Phillies, and way to go, Tribe. Tribe is off tonight, and they won't play again until tomorrow night. But so for EJ and I, it will be the battle of the miles. And hopefully we will see them in the World Series. Now, how optimistic am I? In the basketball, which, you know, sort of takes back seat for me when baseball season starts, but it looks like it's the Heat against the Mavericks. I live in Cleveland, so, of course, I'll be pulling for the Mavericks. So now we're all waiting for that series to start. Jim's much better at doing sports than I am, but, you know, I have to hold down the fort for him. You know, I love baseball. A lot of people love baseball. We've seen bench-emptying brawls in baseball. I mean, my favorite brawl used to be between my pinstripes of New York and the Red Sox of Boston, because they seem to have been able to mix it up pretty good. But, you know, usually in those bench-emptying brawls, there's really a serious injury. But you can't say the same thing for the catcher and the runner collisions that happen at home plate. Some of those are very serious, and Major League Baseball is taking another look at that, because yesterday Buster Posey of the Giants, he'll be nursing a busted leg, and he'll be out of commission for a year after his collision at home plate with the Florida Marlins' Scott Cousins. And the bad thing for the Giants is that Buster Posey was there, I think, their relief hitter. And so now the team is a big loss for that team. And so that begs the question, are there some things that Major League Baseball needs to look at when you talk about how bases are protected? I've been watching baseball almost all my life, and it's supposed to be a non-contact sport. But, of course, there's lots of contact in baseball. So we hope Buster will be on the mend soon, and hopefully it won't take him a year to get better. You know, the news is very strange these days. They used to talk about a nation divided. This nation is divided along many lines. People are still unhappy with health care reform, so there are two camps for health care reform. People disagree vehemently on budgets and fuel and a lot of things, but right now immigration is a big issue, and now the state of Georgia, it has jumped on the bandwagon, and they also want to interfere, I guess is a good word, with who lives where and who works where. And, you know, it's the age-old argument here that employers should be punished for hiring quote unquote illegal aliens. And most of these quote unquote illegal aliens represent the browning of America. But just to put everything into perspective, as bad as that situation is, we have illegal aliens here from almost every country in the world. People who deliberately let their visas expire, people who've been here for years, working, paying taxes, undetected, creating goods and services that all of us use. So it's sort of a double-edged sword, because if they were to get rid of all of that, all of the members of that labor force, prices would be a lot different. Products would cost a lot more. Services would be a lot different. So it's unfortunate that in its infinite wisdom, the United States allowed this situation to get to the point where it is. But it would be very interesting if state by state, every state decided to challenge and defend or deny rights for people who are in this country illegally. I know a few Canadians who are here illegally and have been here for years, working in prominent positions, working unquestioned. So that's an issue that, as a nation, it needs to be decided fairly quickly. Now, with all this rain and all this budding and all this greenery, you know, a few weeks ago the trees were bare. Then it kept raining and raining and raining, and before you knew it, leaves were out, flowers were out, bushes were out, crap was floating around in the air like crazy. I have asthma, and I have allergies, so for me, it makes a huge difference. But CBS News did some research, and they have the list of the 12 worst cities when it comes to allergies. Number 12 is always best to, you know, start at the bottom of the list and work down, but number 12 is Riverside, San Bernardino, California. In the 11th spot is Los Angeles, which I don't think comes as any surprise. And in 10th spot is my wonderful North Coast city of Cleveland. In the 9th spot is Atlanta. In the 8th spot is Cincinnati. In the 9th spot is Chicago. And apparently the Windy City isn't windy enough to blow around, to blow away all that stuff in the air that makes us sneeze and cough and feel miserable. In the sixth position is, Eddie will like this, in the sixth position is the sixth worst city to live in if you have allergies is Philadelphia. The fifth city is Boston. The fourth city is Washington, D.C. The third worst city is Baltimore. The second worst city is Phoenix, and that comes as a big surprise to people, but there's a lot of crap in the air in Phoenix. And the number one city for that is the worst city for allergies is Dallas, Texas. So it's hard to work around. A lot of people live in these cities. There's a lot of industry in these cities, but these are the worst cities if you have an allergy. So you can't avoid them, but you know what you're up against. So that's that list. And who is it? Some late-night pundit always has a bunch of lists. Is it David Letterman? I don't really stay up that late, but because my day starts so early. But I have lists tonight, and normally I wouldn't have lists, but Coach Jim is away, so I have to hold on the fort, and he will pay for it, trust me. He will have to do the show alone one day, and that ought to be very interesting. I will be listening to that show. We're going to have a doctor on later, but, you know, people go to the doctor, and I think I talked about this in an earlier show, where people aren't truthful with doctors. A lot of guys will go to I have some clients who had issues with erectile dysfunction, and so they wouldn't go to their – they were too embarrassed to go to their regular doctor. So they went to another doctor, and they didn't tell the other doctor their whole medical story. They just wanted the medication. So they got the medication. Some of them ran into problems with blood pressure, and then a couple of guys ended up in the emergency room. And when they asked them about their medication, they were a little hesitant because their family doctor was asking the questions. So no matter what you need, no matter what's wrong, your doctor is the last person you should ever lie to. And when you go for a visit, there are a lot of mistakes that people make. You know, cell phones make everybody, they make people crazy. They make me crazy. People talk on cell phones in the doctor's office. Joy Behar bragged about talking on her cell phone while she was getting her annual pap test. And really, nobody thought it was funny. Everybody thought, well, this is a strange time, you know, to be talking on the phone. And the equivalent of the exam for men, there are guys who talk on the phone during that exam, too. So I find that all very strange, that the focus is more on the telephone than it is on what's happening with the doctor. The second thing that people do is they lie. They lie about a lot of things. They lie about symptoms. They lie about sexuality. They lie about drinking. They lie about doing drugs. They lie about having affairs and not using condoms. They lie about different medications they're taking that doctor didn't prescribe. They lie about any number of things that can impact on the way that they're being treated. People lie about doing a sloppy job about describing their pain. You know, when you ask, doctors will ask you on a scale of 1 to 10, where is your pain? Well, a couple of years ago, my back hurt so bad I could barely put my foot on the ground, and I was walking like I was 1,000 years old. And I got out of my car, I was in the middle of a Walmart parking lot, and I literally could not move. I was just stuck there, almost frozen in time. So when I finally got to the doctor, and he said, on a scale of 1 to 10, how's your pain? And I said, on a scale of 1 to 10, my pain is at 10,000. So he got the message that, yeah, something is really, really hurting me. But when they ask you, is it a stabbing pain or burning pain, people will lie or they'll say, I don't know, it just hurts. Well, you know the difference between feeling like something is stabbing you and feeling like something is burning you. Or they'll say, is the pain sudden or is it constant? And I love this answer because a lot of people will say, it's suddenly constant. So, you know, and really the doctor is asking about the onset of your pain more than anything else. And, you know, that's the thing, that a doctor is only as good as your answers. He's only as good as his patient's answers. And if you don't give him the right answers, he can't make the right diagnosis. When they ask you where it hurts, this is where people get a little strained. You know, if it's someplace above the waist, oh, you know, my stomach hurts, my chest hurts, my arm hurts, my neck hurts, or whatever. If it's someplace below, they'll just say down there. Well, if you really look at your body from your waist to your toes, there's a lot of territory down there. So you have to be pretty specific. And you have to talk about intensity, how it started, what provoked it, how long it's lasted. You know, that sort of thing. And so doctors recommend that a week before your appointment, you keep a diary of your pain and other symptoms so that you can think about it and formulate questions that you want to ask the doctor. The fourth mistake people make is they don't state up front all the reasons for your visit. If you're there for one reason, 10 reasons, or whatever, you need to tell them. My head hurts, my back hurts, my arm hurts, or my whole body hurts, or my ankle hurts, or whatever. Which ankle? You know, don't do the other right thing. It's either your left ankle or your right ankle. Or some people will say, I don't know. You know, it just hurts. So you have to tell them what it is. If your ear hurts or your knee pops out when you run or you got crap coming out of the corner of your eye, tell them everything. My ear hurts, my knee pops, I got crap coming out of my eye, you know, whatever. My jaw hurts. Everything that hurts, that's your opportunity to let them know what's going on with you. Also, doctors diagnose and treat us but they work for us. We don't work for them. They don't pay us to be patients. We pay them to provide a service. So you have to state up front what your expectations are. You know, I had a doctor who said, you come to see me because you're fat. Well, I've been fat all my life, but I haven't seen him all my life. And really, since he wasn't a weight doctor, going to see him because I was fat was out of the question, not to mention the fact that being fat had nothing to do with the reason that I was there. So you have to talk about your expectations. If you expect medication, then you should say that. That doesn't mean you're going to get it, but you can say, you know, I expect something to help my ear. I'm here to get something to help my ear. And you have to be honest, you know. I mean, of course, some people, their expectations are out of proportion with what reality is. But if you don't talk to the doctor, he has no idea what your expectations are. And you don't know what medications you're taking. Okay. If you have a laundry list of drugs, get a business card and turn it vertically and write down all your drugs and then put it in your wallet or put it in your purse. And ladies, if you put it in a purse, put it in your purse where you can find it, because, you know, we have a tendency to put stuff in our purse, and then when we look for it, we got to dump, and it's not really a purse anymore at that point. It's more like a shoulder footlocker. You don't want to be doing that. You want to put the card someplace where you can find it easily and where you can go over the medication list with your doctor, because a lot of times people medications are changed, and some people are still taking the old medication when they shouldn't. If you take supplements, you should bring them. If you take valerian root and you know, you use ginger capsules or CoQ10 or even vitamin D, vitamin C, you should tell them all of that. Everything you're taking, you should never leave with unspoken questions and concerns. For some reason, and I wrote a paper about this a few months ago, for some reason, people go to the doctor and they sit there, and the scenario is something like, you know, they get their vitals taken, they're taken to a room, they sit there and they wait for the doctor to show up. Then all of a sudden they go silent. You know, a doctor will say, how you doing? And people always say, I'm okay. If you were okay, you wouldn't be there. Even if it's for a checkup, you being okay is predicated upon the results of the exam. So you're either there for a regular checkup, you're there because you need new refills or whatever, but you have to say why you are there, and a lot of people don't do it. And on the way out the door, they'll say, you know, by the way, doc, well, you've used up your time, and so now you want to do one of these by-the-way things. And most doctors are not good at diagnosing or treating people with the oh, by-the-way situation. It doesn't work because it leaves too many unanswered questions and concerns. You know, if you go there and you have a headache and you're worried that your headache might be a brain tumor, you can say that. Even if you think you sound like a hypochondriac, who knows? You aren't a doctor. That's why you're there. So you have to talk about the headache, and you have to talk about how long you've had it and whatever. But the whole point is you don't leave with unspoken questions and concerns. If you are seeing a new doctor, a lot of people don't bring their medical records or their x-rays or results of scans or whatever. These things are all very important to the new doctor treating you. And if you don't have them, it only delays treatment, and you have to make another appointment. And if you waited a long time for that appointment, guess what? You probably wait just as long for them to send the records and everything. So you can get them. You have the right to get them. And, you know, I love this one. You're too scared to disagree with your doctor. If you're sick and your life is in jeopardy, who's in peril, you or the doctor? I mean, truly, your headache won't kill the doctor. And if he says, you know, sometimes doctors say, you know, you need an antidepressant and you don't want to take it. Tell them. Ask if there's an alternative therapy. But don't take the prescription and then throw it away the minute you're out the door. Or if they suggest a medication that you can't afford, tell them you can't afford it. There's always, you know, they work on what we tell them. You know, they can make suggestions. If you don't want to follow them, you have the right to say, I don't believe that would work for me, or I can't afford it, or what are the side effects? You know, how do they interact with what I'm already taking or what I'm already doing? You know, this one doctor says, if the treatment plan I suggest doesn't resonate the intuitive wisdom in your inner healer, please tell me instead of just ignoring what I suggest. I mean, you have a right. Remember what I said. The doctors work for you, not the other way around, but their skill is only as beneficial as you letting them know what's going on with you. And a lot of people have real issue with telling doctors the truth. The worst thing you can do is not comply with the treatment plan. This defeats the purpose of going to the doctor in the first place. I mean, if you aren't going to do what, if you agree on a treatment plan and then you aren't going to follow it, what's the point? If you take medication that you're supposed to be taking every day and you decide you're going to take it every third day, that's not following the plan. If you have an antibiotic and you don't take it until you finish it, you should tell a doctor that. They just need to know. I mean, they're not going to sit in judgment and jump all over you because, listen, if you have high blood pressure and you don't take your medicine every day, you already know you did the wrong thing. But if your blood pressure skyrockets, the doctor needs to know that you weren't taking it so that he won't prescribe an additional drug. He'll know that you didn't comply with the original treatment plan. Or if you're still limping after 6 weeks, because you refuse to do physical therapy or you refuse to do the soaks or the wraps or whatever, they need to know that. Because in the absence of not following the treatment plan and the situation persists, then they have to look for new causes of what's going on with you. And you know how I am. I'm very big on people telling the truth, especially to their doctors. You never lie to your lawyer. You never lie to your doctor. I would prefer if you didn't lie to your significant other, but I, you know, that's something that you have to live with. But lying to your doctor is a very, very bad thing and a very unhealthy thing, and it defeats the whole purpose of going to the doctor in the first place. We're coming up on the 7 o'clock hour. Eddie seemed surprised that Philadelphia was number 6 in allergies, but it's true, you are, and we're hanging in there. We're at number 10, so, you know, there are a lot of cities, and these are just the big cities they went after. They have a lot of small towns that are so bad for people with allergies that they don't even set foot there. So take heart in Philly. You're not the worst. Coming up, like I said, coming up at 7 o'clock, we have a school teacher who wrote a book. Her name is Rebecca Fisher. And she wrote a very interesting book, All the Wrong Places. So after I take a short break, I'm going to come back and I'm going to bring Rebecca on because she's in the queue. Welcome back to Together Again, everybody. I'm Coach Marcia. Coach Jim is away today doing his college planning seminar, and I am going to bring our guest online now. Are you there, Rebecca?
I am.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm good. I want to tell everybody, this is Rebecca Fisher, and she wrote an amazing book. Very interesting and entertaining book, too, called All the Wrong Places. So I'm going to let her tell you a little bit about herself.
Well, like you said, I'm a teacher. I'm a high school English teacher, and literature has just been a passion of mine since I was little, actually. And, you know, I lived through some pretty extraordinary experiences, and sitting in an English class, writing class, I was asked to write a short story, and just started pouring out all those experiences, and over time it formed into a longer story, and this is it.
Well, I want to tell everybody that her longer story is 327 entertaining pages. So as a writer, I know the difference between a short story and a book, and a short story and a novella. And trust me, Rebecca wrote a novel. She wrote a book. What I find interesting, and we're going to get into this, but I want to tell everybody what's on the back cover of the book. Driving aimlessly through the stormy suburbs of San Francisco, Casey Wheeler is fleeing from her abusive and unfaithful husband with her 5-year-old daughter, Maddie, asleep in the back seat. With nowhere to go and no one to turn to, Casey loses control of her emotions and her car, crashing into a hillside below a mortuary. Desperately seeking shelter, and more so independence, she finds herself taken in by the mortuary director, who apprehensively offers her a job and a place to live. As she stumbles through the ins and outs of her new and morbid surroundings, Casey is forced into a hostile custody battle with her relentless and increasingly violent husband. In the midst of all the chaos, she finds a new family and even love in the eccentric and protective people of Golden Oaks Funeral Home. But just when she has found all she can hope for, she will have to fight to the death to protect it. And this is a semi-autobiographical story. So I want to let Casey take you through what you told us a little bit about what prompted you to write the book. Why did you decide to make it just semi-autobiographical?
You know, one of my favorite authors, Anne Lamott, she talks about how her nonfiction writing had some serious consequences with her family. And she kind of said, I'll just paraphrase what she said about writing. She said, your story is your story and you need to tell it. But fiction is just as good as nonfiction for doing that. And for me, you know, I have a lot of relationships that I value, and fiction is a way of sharing my experiences, the feelings that went along with that, without jeopardizing those relationships in the same way as a nonfiction story might do.
I understand that. I do the same thing, but I'm a lot older than you, so I probably have a lot more people that I don't want to mention by name and directly in any book. But what I do is I just chop it up into years. Like I'll take, you know, the year that I was 6 years old and incorporate it into one book, and I do it little by little. So I guess that means I have to write like 60 books.
Mm-hmm.
But so what was it like, the mortuary business? What was it like living there?
At first it was terrifying. I actually married a mortician, and we lived in the apartment off of the mortuary. So literally you would open the door and be in the hallway of the mortuary, and it took me a long time to walk through that door. I would use the back door to go out into the parking lot, but learning to be around death, it took a while, but I have to say that once I stepped into that hallway, it wasn't long before that became just a part of life. Death became a natural thing. You saw it every day, and so it didn't spook me as much after a while.
How did your daughter feel about that?
Well, I actually had her and brought her home to the mortuary, but she only lived there until she was just just a year old maybe, so she doesn't have many memories of that. We did live in another apartment next to a mortuary, but she wasn't around that. So I think she got a kick out of reading the book to kind of see through me what it was like there.
How much of you is in the book? I know as I was reading it, as a reader, I could see a lot. I could possibly see a lot of you in here. I guess my question is the character Casey. Running away is very difficult, of course. And apparently she had just decided that she had enough abuse and that it was time to go, which is a decision a lot of women find hard to make.
Right.
How much of that was a part of your own life?
The abusive marriage and having to leave that and living the consequences of that, that's all real. That's all my life. I changed some of the circumstances, but those are real. Having to go through that, getting out of that, going through the divorce and the custody and the courts and all of that was very real. The relationship with Maddie, the daughter, that's very much my relationship with my daughter. So a lot of those situations are my story. Some of the circumstances are a little different, the backdrop's a little different, but it's me. All of that in there is me.
Was the book in any way cathartic for you?
Oh, yeah. You know, every time I write, I get a new perspective on the past. And so over time, I've really grown. I'm about 10 years out from that situation. So, you know, the more time goes by, the more I see it maybe clearer. And writing this story gave me compassion for myself. I know that when I was going through that that marriage and getting out of it, I was really in survival mode. I know a lot of women go through something similar. For a long time, I kind of minimized it. I denied it, whatever it took to just survive day by day. But writing the story, I really learned to have compassion for myself and look at the situation for what it was and the courage I had to walk through it and, you know, just immense gratitude for the people that came along in my life and helped me through it.
Okay. As a person who has firsthand knowledge of that situation, why did you stay as long as you did?
You know, each incident would come with apologies and this is the only time, it'll never happen again, or you're crazy. It wasn't that big of a deal, and I wanted to believe that. I wanted to believe that because my only other option was frightening to me. Leaving and being on my own with a baby, that was terrifying to me. I didn't really have anybody, so it would be all me, which it ended up being, and it was terrifying. I had every right to be terrified of that, but you know, it got to the point where I knew someone was going to get really hurt or maybe killed, and that just was a line I wasn't willing to have crossed. So, yeah.
I'm around page 106, and, well, I guess I should go back to, 106. I'm on page 106. Where you say there's some action that has happened, where you say someone said, you're making a big mistake. You know, some people might consider this an inappropriate and harmful environment to raise a child, mm-hmm. Where this is the husband talking. You should think about that, Casey. Someone might start asking whether you're fit to be a parent. His calculating smile returned, and my blood seemed to boil just beneath my skin. You wouldn't dare. The disorienting and violent feeling I'd had before I shoved him at the house had returned and doubled. Wouldn't I, he challenged. And then further down you say, where you say, I was shocked and a bit concerned by his threat. I instinctively took a step back, and he began to reach for me through the door. That happens a lot. That happens to a lot of women in that situation where I always say you can't reason with an unreasonable person, and you can't rationalize with an irrational person.
Right.
And, you know, so now you're at the mortuary. Mm-hmm. And what was it like, you know, with this family? I mean, just to go from being terrified of one situation, because most people are afraid of funeral homes if they haven't, you know, if they don't work there or if they didn't grow up there. I happen to know a couple of people who grew up in funeral homes. Why did you decide to work there?
Well, that is actually the character who works there. I didn't actually work at the mortuary. I just lived there. I did do things after hours like collect the flower cards, make sure there's tissue in the tissue boxes, clean the bathrooms. I helped put makeup on the bodies, dress them, but I wasn't technically an employee. I have the character take that job because it shows the desperation I had. I was willing to do anything at that point because I was on my own. I was alone with a baby, and I had to be willing. I had to be willing to do whatever it took to survive and take care of her, which, as hard as it was better than staying in that abusive environment.
So how did you meet your now husband?
I actually met him online about... 8 years ago, a friend of mine talked me into going onto a dating site, which I just thought was silly. But she happened to meet her husband there, so I gave it a try. And after a few just awful dates with some strange people, I met him and was just so relieved. I felt at home with him right away. And over time, you know, it was just a blessing. I look back in awe sometimes. I can't believe I got that second chance, but he's pretty amazing. He's just as amazing as Oliver in the book, I have to say. That is him. So he's not a doctor, but he is just as amazing.
Well, everybody knows I'm a big fan of online dating. That's how I met Coach Jim. and we've been together since the very first date. So... but, of course, I met some very, I would say, quote, interesting, unquote, people.
Oh, yeah.
Because you never know what lurks in the shadows of online dating. You seem happy now. Tell us a little bit about teaching.
Oh, boy. Well, I come from a line of teachers. My mom's a teacher. My grandmother was a teacher. They actually had a school together for a while. Of course, as a teenager, I swore I would never, ever teach. I just didn't want to be like them. But I started off teaching science, doing little science experiments with little kids, and it just was so natural. And after I got my degree in English, I thought, what am I going to do with myself? I might as well teach in the meantime. So I got a job, and I've just fallen in love with it. I get to share my passion, and it's just so much fun to watch these kids fall in love with literature and share that passion with you. Not all of them, of course. They don't all share that passion, but it's great, and I get to share my life story with them, my miracles and my second chances and my mistakes and the lessons I've learned. I get to share all of that and watch them take some of it and apply it to their lives, which is such a blessing.
I want to tell everybody that I'm talking with Rebecca Fisher, and she wrote the book All the Wrong Places. But it seems like all the places weren't wrong, because it seems like the mortuary was a good place for her. It seems like teaching is a good place for her. Tell everybody where they can buy the book and how they can reach you.
Okay. You can buy the book at my website, RebeccaFisherBooks.com. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, you can find it anywhere online. You can contact me through my website, which again is RebeccaFisherBooks.com, and I can communicate with you that way.
Any plans for another book?
Oh, I have dozens roaming around in my mind. So as soon as the school year's over, I'm going to sit down and try to pour some more out. I'm looking forward to that.
Well, for anybody who has ever written a book, it's sort of like those Frito-Lay things. You can't eat just one. You can't write just one book.
Mm-hmm.
Because so much stuff, and I know the feeling because I have the same issue, that you have all these things because life experiences for a lot of people, especially writers, translate into wonderful stories, and the stories become linked, and before you know it, like Rebecca said earlier, you end up with a book. If you have a good story, and it's not about being, it's not so much about being a good writer, because I disagree with a lot of people who say you can teach a person how to write. I don't believe you can teach a person how to write. I think that you are either born with the talent to write, which includes a passion for writing, or you're just going to turn out sort of milquetoast issues that won't be very interesting because your heart isn't in it. But for people like Rebecca who have compelling stories to tell, and as you read, as you turn the pages, you can see and feel the passion as you read the book. This is what makes a book interesting. This is what makes a writer good. It's not about a wall full of paper from some university saying you have a master's in creative writing. That doesn't mean anything except you did your homework. And, you know, that doesn't mean anybody's going to read anything you wrote. But I want to thank Rebecca for being on the show, and I want to ask my listeners, because summer is coming and because Oprah's in repeats and won't be back on, and All My Children and One Life to Live are being canceled, so some of you will have a lot of extra time this summer. Reading All the Wrong Places could be a good way to fill some of that time. So. Thank you, Rebecca. Good luck with the book. And when you write the next one, you'll be back on together again. How's that?
Great. Thank you very much.
Tell everybody one more time where they can find your book.
RebeccaFisherBooks.com or Amazon, Barnes & Noble, any online bookstore has it.
Sounds good. Have a good summer. Everybody, get Rebecca's book. After this message, we'll be back with Allison, and she's going to tell us a compelling story. Thanks for being on the show, Rebecca.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
Bye.
Okay, I want to remind everybody that we have, oh my goodness. Okay. Hi, everybody. I'm Coach Marcia, and I'm back online. Unfortunately, like I said, there's storms in the area, so that's why we got bounced off. But we're back on the line now. And are you there, Allison?
I am, Coach Marcia. How are you?
I'm good. I am so sorry, but we have severe storms everywhere. And so because the show comes through the Internet, we have been getting bounced off, which is why I sent the message earlier that in case you called in and there was no one here, that it wasn't intentional. It was just the storms. So I want to tell everybody, we're talking to Allison Manswell, who has an incredible story about how she found her biological father. So I'm going to let Allison introduce herself, and I'm going to let her tell you her story. So it's all yours, Allison.
Well, thank you, Coach Marcia. Thank you for the invitation and certainly for being interested in my story. You know, since telling it, I really have been so surprised and overwhelmed by how people have embraced it. So I'll start at the beginning. Back in 1988, the movie Coming to America came out, and I was just fascinated, actually obsessed with this movie. And so I used to just sit in the theater all day Saturday watching this movie. So I came home, I told my mother, oh my gosh, you have to go see this movie. It's amazing. It's so powerful. And so my mother comes and sees the movie with me, and she says, Allison, the movie's not that powerful, but I certainly understand why you are so obsessed with it. There is something that I was going to tell you when you turn 21, but I might as well go ahead and tell you now. And she proceeds to tell me that the person that I thought was my father all of those years was, in fact, not my father, and that I was born after her husband, who was an abusive spouse, had beaten her one New Year's Eve. And, you know, she was really upset because it was just one of those days that she decided to be defiant, and her defiance led her to, you know, a pretty severe beating. And she just decided that as she was lying there basically on the bedroom floor, just left in her own, you know, sadness, that she wasn't going to go out like that, not tonight. So she got herself together. She went to a New Year's Eve party with some student nurses who were also training at the hospital where she was working. And there happened to be a young student doctor who had expressed some interest in her before, but of course, you know, because she was married and my mother was queen appropriate, you know, so she never really bothered with him. But on this night, I would imagine that this was her breaking point. And so they were together on that New Year's Eve night. And when she became pregnant with me, she made the decision to not tell him. She had also received her papers to move from London, where she was living, to Canada. And so because she was leaving, she just decided, you know what, this is just something she's not going to discuss. She moved to Canada, and here I am. So she's telling me this story now 20 years later, and a lot of things in my life, you know, really made sense at that point. I kind of understood the relationship I had with this man who grew up as my father. I knew intuitively something was wrong, something was different, that I wasn't his favorite child, and I really just rationalized and thought it was because my sister looked just like him and I didn't, so I thought that, you know, maybe that was it. And nonetheless, I was okay with it. One of the extraordinary things my mother did was give me a phenomenal sense of self. She taught me that, you know, I was definitely born of love. If she had had the courage, she would have run away with him, and I'm sure they would have had a wonderful life together. But she wanted me to grow up always with a sense of courage. She told me as well that education was my key to choices, and that with a good education, I would always be able to make choices in my life that were based on what I really wanted and not what I had to do. And to be quite honest, she also gave me the message that I should always respect the man that I grew up with, because he made a choice to continue to raise me as his daughter, even though she eventually told him the truth. And so this sum total of backdrop really helped me to grow up feeling very good about myself. I always did have that need to be daddy's little girl. I can say that that's been a predominant theme in my life, but I don't think it overtook my life. It was just sort of something I always wanted. So as the Internet became more popular, I would do Internet searches. I picked up the phone and I would call the different hospitals in London. And I, you know, would just try to do my own little search and find my father on my own, because really all I had was his name and the fact that he was a doctor and where he studied. But, you know, I had no idea. For many, many years, I thought he was Nigerian, so here I was even looking in the wrong country. And I will tell you that it wasn't until late last year, as I was going through, you know, a major life crisis in, you know, in my life, I decided that I needed to let this go. This need, the urge, the desire to find my father, I needed to let it go because chances are I wasn't going to find him. And so I really found my peace. I became at peace with the fact that I would not find my father and that, you know, God had always been all the father that I really needed, and I made that enough. Now, ironically, in late January, I called the first person I grew up with as my father. We were having a conversation, and this whole notion of me not being his child came up again, and I was really shocked by his response now, 21 years later. I was really disappointed. I was shocked. I felt like he wasn't telling me the truth, and I started to get this feeling like, you know what, I think I want to find my father, my real father. About 3 days later, I sat in my living room watching the Oprah Winfrey Show, and that was the episode where Oprah's half-sister, Patricia, actually
yeah.
found her, and Oprah was telling the story about finding her sister, or frankly, her sister finding her. And I sat there watching the show, but analyzing the degree of miracles that led to Patricia finding Oprah. And in a moment, I said to myself, I can do that. Actually, I want that too. I want that moment. And it's one of those things where the moment itself is so crystal clear in my memory because everything inside of me decided I will find my father because I want that moment also. And if those series of miracles could happen for Patricia, they could happen for me also. So the week goes on, and that Sunday in church, my pastor happened to be preaching a sermon that was called Your Glory is in Your Story. And he was talking about the fact that everybody has this story that we never really, you know, get out, and it never comes to fruition. It's never able to help other people because we sit on the story. And then I just decided to go and ask him. All of a sudden, a light bulb came on, and I thought to myself, wait a second. The church does work in Ghana. Why don't I ask him if he knows anybody and maybe start a brand new search with a little bit more help? Because obviously my way is not working. I did that. I went to him, asked him for his help. He said absolutely, he would help me. And then I basically went home and I said, you know what, let me try to help myself. I'm going to go back on Google and do the same thing that I have been doing for 22 years. I put his name in Google, press search. And this
Let me stop you there for a minute. I have two guests in the queue, and I want to tell everybody, because we got knocked off, we're running a few minutes behind, so please stay in the queue. I'm going to let Allison discuss a little bit more of her story, and then I'm going to bring her back on another day so she can talk more about her story. But the weather has worked against me tonight, time-wise. So please, everybody, just for those of you in the queue, please stay there. And Allison, please continue your story.
Oh, sure.
Because we have actually about 5 more minutes.
Okay.
So.
All right, great. Well, really, Google just gave me a corrected spelling. I was able to take that corrected spelling, and on Facebook, I looked up everybody with that last name. I sent them a cryptic little note asking for any information they might have on Dr. Harry Sinqua Mills and came back with a couple people who turned out to be my cousins. And so that is the story of how I actually found my father.
And how do you feel? Do you have a relationship with him now?
Well, this story is actually bittersweet because after finding his family, I found out that he's actually passed away a few years ago. But his nieces and nephews, his brother, and then his son is still alive. So I have established a contact with all of them, and I will be going to Ghana in July.
I want to our show is going on hiatus June 9th, but when we come back in the fall, I would like to have you back on so you could tell us what that trip was like, if that's okay with you.
Oh, absolutely. I'm sure I'm going to have lots to share when I get back.
Well, I will be looking forward to it. And I'm sorry, like, the time, just it's time tonight with the storm just didn't work for me. But I wanted to get everybody on because everybody was kind enough to stand by and everything. I want to tell everybody, I've been talking to Allison Manswell. She will be back, actually, because she was sort of, she and I didn't really get to talk much because I heard her story and I thought it was so compelling. I wanted to put her on the schedule today. And I'm glad I did because now that we've been introduced to you, we will all be waiting to hear what happened after you went to Ghana.
Oh, wonderful. I'll be happy to come back and share that part of the story.
Before you go, though, tell everybody where they can find you.
Oh, absolutely.
Where your website is.
Sure. My website is allisonmanswell.com. That's allisonmanswell.com. And the book, I actually wrote a series of poetic essays that I put into a book, and the book is available at the website.
Thank you for being on the show, Allison, and we'll get together and coordinate the time for you to be on the show when we resume in the fall.
Okay, wonderful. Well, thank you so much. Good luck to you.
My pleasure. Have a good trip, and we'll talk to you in the fall.
Okay, thank you, ma'am.
All right, bye. Are you there, caller?
I am here.
Well, I want to tell everybody, and thank you so much, Dr. Porter, for standing by.
No problem.
As I was explaining to Allison, we have severe storms in the area, and because this is an internet show, we got bounced off earlier, and so I tried to get back on so that I could get all the guests on, and I tried to send emails to everybody to let them know what was going on. I want to tell everybody that our guest for this segment is Dr. William Porter. And the subject, because it was brought to me by someone who's heard the show before, is about pelvic organ prolapse. And the person who wrote me the email, who just finished a documentary for PBS, I think, said that one of the problems, and I've had a show before about women's issues that men should know about, is that oftentimes men, women who back away from intimacy, sometimes that action is misinterpreted by the men in their lives. And part of that has to do at times with pelvic organ prolapse. Stand by for just one moment because there's someone else. Are you there, caller?
Hi, Marcia. This is Sherry. Sure, I'm here, hon.
Okay. I was telling Dr. Porter that you were the person who prompted this show on pelvic organ prolapse. So, Dr. Porter, for all our listeners out there, what exactly is pelvic organ prolapse?
Sure, yeah. Pelvic organ prolapse is a medical condition that kind of occurs when the normal support of the vagina is lost, resulting in a sagging or dropping of the bladder, the urethra, the uterus, or even the rectum occasionally. As the prolapse of the vagina and the uterus progresses, some women may feel like a bulge, a bulging tissue, something protruding through the opening of the vagina.
And, of course, this would make intimacy difficult?
Well, a lot of it is, in reality, it wouldn't affect intercourse, but I think it's a misconception by both the woman suffering from the prolapse as well as their fear that their partner may discover something abnormal, so they feel that they may, you know, stay underneath the covers, they might not turn the lights on, they avoid anything that remotely adventurous, they don't really want to have their partner realize that maybe there's something, you know, they think is wrong with them. But it's quite common, and it shouldn't affect intimacy at all. It should really, you know, with the fact of intercourse, it wouldn't play a role. It's something that a female would have to kind of come to grips with, and it won't really affect their sexual function by any means.
Except from an emotional standpoint.
Right. So, and that's a big component. The emotional aspect of intercourse or sexual intimacy with females, it does play a big role. But the actual physical role, it doesn't make a difference. But so the biggest misconception is that, yes, it's a normal part of aging, normal part of having children, and you can look beyond it. It's not going to hurt you. You're not going to make it worse. Your partner won't know the difference. And you really shouldn't play a role. It shouldn't affect your quality of life, you know. And if it's affecting your quality of life, you really need to get some help. And maybe is there something a physician or something simple they could do to help, you know, fix this, correct this problem. But you shouldn't let it affect your life in that regard.
Okay, Sherry, jump in anytime you want to.
Okay, Marcia, I wasn't sure if I should go ahead and say anything or just hover in the back here until you call on me. With all due respect, Dr. Porter, I'd like to throw in my two cents here. I speak with women. I have actually got a nonprofit for pelvic organ prolapse, and I had surgical treatment for cystocele, rectocele, and enterocele, three of the five types of POP. And I speak with women on a regular basis, on a weekly basis, about the impact to their lives, both physically and emotionally. And the sexual component is a huge part of that. For women who have pain with intercourse, it's not always related to pelvic organ prolapse, but it sometimes is. And for women who have got the urinary or fecal incontinence, that's related to pelvic organ prolapse. And those are both relatively common. It's just not talked about. Those are those issues that are still kept behind closed doors. It has a huge roll-off to the intimacy factor because if a woman, if you have to have concerns about having leakage, coital leakage, or you know any kind of stuff coming out when you're having that active intimacy, what are you going to do? You're going to withdraw from that intimacy completely. And so oftentimes the women that I connect with tell me that what happens with them is there's so much embarrassment tied to this. There's so much concern about having that urinary or fecal leakage occur during that active intimacy that rather than risk that happening, they just stop. They just shut down. And then, of course, because they're so embarrassed about, you know, the potential of that happening, they don't even discuss it with their husbands or their boyfriends, the men in their lives. And then that has a shift to the relationship factor because men often, and this sounds so stereotypical, and I hate to go to that page, but men may tend to feel that the woman is just no longer interested in sex, and that is simply not the case. You know, sometimes they feel that, men might feel that maybe she's either just not into me anymore or perhaps she's even having an affair. And so rather than having a dialogue, everything just shuts down, and then there's dysfunction in the relationship and the baggage of worms. Honestly, when I speak about POP in the public setting, I can have a two-hour seminar about all the different aspects of POP. The aspect I get the biggest reaction to, and I'm talking all the time, is the impact of intimacy. It's a huge bucket of worms. It really, really is. So not all women have pain with intercourse when they have POP. I'm one of the lucky ones. I did not have pain. But it's relatively common. And this is particularly common, I think, in the younger women that have POP. I read articles all the time and studies and so on about POP, and they will say, typically it's a 50-above dynamic in these studies, but I speak with women in their 20s and 30s on a regular basis that have got different types of POP going on. And for women that are younger, there's a much more likelihood of having the pain factor in this health issue. And so for them, because they're younger, they have a more dynamic sex life. And I got to say, I'm not saying that, you know, once you get past it, you don't, because as a 57-year-old, I love my sexuality. But when you're young, it has a real smack-in-the-face effect to you. And so these women have got just huge concerns about, is my husband going to leave me? I want to keep him happy. For women, the sexual act has got so much to do with that emotional connection to our men. It's above and beyond that physical. For all women, it's so much that emotional connection. You know, you want to have that strong bond. And whether you have an orgasmic sex life or not as a woman, you still want that connection. And when you have pain with intercourse or you pull back because you have to worry about stuff coming out, well, that impacts that hugely. It really does.
Well, I have a question because, you know, out of fairness to everybody, you know, Dr. Porter included, I think a lot of times when you talk about, first of all, I have to say, whenever I go to the doctor, Coach Jim is sitting there in a chair in the room with me. So he is a part of the overall visit. Dr. Porter, do you think that by having the male significant other in a person's life could be informative and educational to the point where the men would understand what's going on and why it's going on? And I know that there are treatment modalities out there. So, you know, how do you feel about that scenario?
You know, if the patient is willing to have the partner in the room, I love to have that, because it's, you can kind of approach it from both aspects. You can kind of educate both people at the same time and tell them what kind of role this may play a role in their sexual function, in their lives, how it may impact or not impact their lives. And going back to what she was saying earlier, is that if there's some pain with intercourse, prolapse doesn't really cause pain. So there might be an underlying issue causing the pain. It could be vaginal dryness. It could be some other thing. So that was something you have to kind of explore beyond blaming prolapse, especially in the younger patients. There might be other things that's causing the pain beyond prolapse. But educating the male partner or the significant other, whoever it may be, is very important, because I think it allows them to share their experience, what they may be thinking. You know, it's not abnormal. I mean, this is something it does develop with life. And, you know, as I say earlier, that, you know, your loss of tissue strength as time goes on, it's like your face starts to sag, you know, and your arms start to waggle a little bit, and you just kind of, the prolapse will come out just from having children. And it's a normal part of the body developing and changing. But if it's causing a rift or it's causing a problem, either in the relationship or with the patient themselves, or they're thinking there's something wrong, they definitely need to seek help. And you know, bringing their partner with them will help both of them together to understand this and kind of see what their options may be. And that's not always surgery. There's some very basic things we can do. And surgery doesn't always have to be performed. And so you could either just do some Kegel exercises, strengthening the pelvic floor. And there's basic things there's braces such as a pessary that we use that as well. And people have intercourse with that as well. And so there's things, basic things we can understand. There's basic things we can tell the partners. They can have more of an open relationship. And as she was saying, this is a barrier not only for women to discuss this with their partners. They don't discuss it with their doctors. And on the other hand, a lot of the primary care doctors they may see, they don't want to bring up the subject either, because they're uncomfortable talking about it. They may be uncomfortable with their own sexuality, and they don't want to discuss this with their patients. So there's barriers on both sides. And, you know, subspecialists as myself or even other gynecologists, you know, we deal with this all the time, and we're more apt to, you know, bring out this, discuss this with them, discuss their changes of their body that may be going on through time and having children, and as their time goes on, there's things that we can help prevent, you know, this problem. Hopefully we can help correct some of this. And getting back to incontinence and fecal incontinence, that's not really, it goes along with prolapse, but prolapse doesn't cause those problems. So you're dealing with multiple different problems in that regard, and the incontinence of urine can be a result from stress incontinence, which is due to maybe some lost support, but there's also orgasmic incontinence, which could be caused from bladder spasms, which is a different issue in general. So we're dealing with multiple problems that she was bringing up, so it's hard to address this prolapse, and there's a few things that, and when I bring patients into the office, we have to understand there's maybe several different things going on. It's not just prolapse, it's maybe this, maybe this, and they could all be treated differently. But again, getting back to your point, yeah, it'd be very important to bring your partner in if you have a receptive partner. And sometimes some partners out there are not receptive to anything, and they don't want to know, which is unfortunate for, you know, the patient as well as society, that we should help take care of our loved ones and understand what they may be going under or going through.
Well, you know,
Dr. Porter, I'm just curious, what's your opinion? I'm sorry, Marcia, go ahead.
Go ahead, Sherry, and then I'll comment. Go ahead.
Okay, I was just curious, Dr. Porter, on what your opinion is about creating some recognition in women prior to childbirthing about the importance of the Kegel pathway and the pelvic floor strengthening pathway, so that there's some recognition about that. Women typically don't even, I mean, everyone's heard about Kegels, but few women recognize the significance of maintaining that pelvic floor strength as a preventative tool. What's your opinion on that?
Yeah, I mean, that's, I'm trying to make an initiative in my own hospital here that, you know, we're trying to educate from, you know, from birth to death, meaning that we're trying to educate females in their pelvic floor, their pelvic health. And you should, just like you go and get on the treadmill, you need to do a Kegel exercise. And I think it's blown off to a point where, oh, I'll do the Kegels, I'm at a stoplight, and I'll start contracting my muscles. That's not how you're supposed to do them. You know, and I assess people all the time how to do a Kegel exercise, and they really don't understand them. And I'm like, this is not going to help you. And it's very important to understand how to do a Kegel properly. You know, and I mm-hmm. and some people get, you know, may not want to hear this, but the easiest way to understand how to do a Kegel is you put a finger in your own vagina, and if you squeeze your muscles right. and you feel tension around that, that's the right muscle. You know, you're not lifting mm-hmm. your butt off the right. ground, you're not doing anything like that. If you understand how to do that, you can prevent when you lift that something heavy, you lift that object, anything you're doing physically, just like you're supposed to use your legs, you can use your Kegel muscles and squeeze them at the same time to prevent that downward force, you know, forcing
sure.
anything.
Right, right, you know, exactly.
What
exactly.
I was going to say earlier is that because Jim and I are relationship coaches, and this is why I do these shows, because I told everybody the show tonight was once again about a topic, a women's topic that men should know about. And, you know, people can't really help you if they don't understand what's going on. And
right.
a lot of times, and that is a definite communication issue. Right before, at the top of the show, I talked about 10 things, 10 mistakes that people make when they see their doctors. And I also talked about when they say, what's wrong? Normally, if what's wrong is from your head to your waist, people will like be like chatterboxes. But if it's something below the waist, then you get this kind of awkward pregnant pause as if they, you
right.
know. And I always tell people, okay, you have to look at your overall health picture compared to any kind of temporary embarrassment you may experience, because this is why you're there, and you can't get the help if no one knows what's going on with you. And it's the same thing with the guys. They have their own issues, too, that they don't bring to the forefront when they visit a doctor. I know just because of what I used to do before, you know, I started – actively doing my relationship coaching. I spent about 20 years in the medical environment. So I knew about pelvic organ prolapse. And I also have a very good OBGYN who told me from day one, you know, I work for you, you're the patient, you know, I have the time, and you have to tell me what's going on. And that's the only way we can have a good relationship. And so we do talk. We talk about everything. And I also include Jim on every visit, so he understands, you know, what's going on, and so we can talk, and he understands, and I understand, and we're on the same page, and so it makes it much easier to form a treatment plan for anything than people who don't talk. And I think that men don't realize that if it's their wife or their significant other or whatever, if they're sitting in that room, they can ask questions. They can ask the doctor questions about what this is, you know, what the impact is on her, because the doctor already said, you know, okay, it's not going to cause painful intercourse, because if you have pain, that's a symptom of something else. But, he, you know, how it impacts her, more emotionally than physically, because as women, a lot of things impact us emotionally. And so I think that huge communication gap is more of an issue than anything else. I also think that women are done a disservice because, as Dr. Porter said, most practitioners do not take that from birth to the grave attitude when it comes to women's health. They sort of treat it on an as need to know basis. You know, like nobody tells, well, now because things have changed, but there was a time when nobody discussed pap tests with 10-year-olds or 12-year-olds. Nobody discusses anything. And when you talk about Kegels, people think it's a joke. They think it's like some Suzanne Summers invented thing where, you know, you want to look like
some
me,
fluff,
you know,
fluff,
you're going to do...
Right,
and they think of it more as some kind of cosmetic cure for your lovely lady parts than they do as something realistic and practical about it. I know you talked about pessaries earlier. I know what they are, but there may be a lot of people in the audience who don't know what they are. So, Dr. Porter, could you tell people what a pessary is?
Sure, great, yeah. We can go back to the Greek times and in the past, and people may not want to hear this, but, you know, with prolapses occurred throughout time, and they used to use stones and pomegranates, and as things progressed in the modern times, we use something called a pessary. And essentially what a pessary is we're in a brace. And just like we're in a knee brace in that kind of regard, it's a brace that we would put in the vagina, and the most common one is called a ring pessary. And it's very similar to if people use a diaphragm. It's kind of similar to that. Kind of looks like a pancake, a little bit thicker on the edges, and that would be inserted into the vagina. And what it will do, it allows the support of the bladder and the uterus and kind of keeps everything in place. So it would lift everything back into the normal position of the pelvic floor. And it's a way to avoid surgery if that's not you're ready for, or you're bothered by the prolapse only when you play tennis or you play golf and you don't want to have surgery and you think this is a great option. And I have patients that use it for years, and it's a great option for a lot of patients. But it's a brace. It's a temporary thing, but you can use long-term in the same time. So it only works when you're using it. You can take it out and leave it out, and your prolapse will come back. So it's not a cure of the prolapse, but it allows to keep that pressure off the pelvic floor, and it allows the restoration of the pelvic floor back up where it's supposed to be. So that's kind of a nutshell what a pessary would kind of be. But there's different shapes and sizes, and you're kind of fitted by your doctor to what type you would need. But most patients can get along with this basic ring pessary, which are the easiest ones to use and to take care of and give you the best relief.
You know, there's so many people go online to look for diet, you know, I call it the indulgence in self-diagnosis and treatment. But, you know, almost all of the sites, if you pull up any site about pelvic organ prolapse, it will mention the Kegels because you need that strength. And one thing I found interesting, and I'm not sure I understand, is the impact of caffeine on pelvic organ prolapse. I don't know. Do you know about that connection, Dr. Porter, or is this just one more thing they've?
Yeah, caffeine really doesn't play a role in pelvic organ prolapse. Pelvic organ prolapse is more of a result of some sort of trauma. So as the child goes through the birth canal, stretches the muscles and nerves out, or just the fact of being pregnant, chronic straining, constipation, smoking, obesity, which is only two reversible things you can really do. And sometimes just your genes, your family history, you're more apt to have prolapse. But what caffeine really plays a role in is more of an overactive bladder, which goes along with pelvic organ prolapse frequently. And that would be something where you have the urinary frequency, the urgency, maybe the bladder spasms with, then you get urinary incontinence. But caffeine wouldn't play a role with actually the loss of the support of the tissues. It's more of the overactive bladder and causing urinary frequency, urgency, urinary incontinence, which would be caused by the caffeine, but nothing that affect the pelvic floor and support. So it wouldn't cause any support problems.
Okay. See, everybody, this is why I bring the experts on instead of Googling things, because everybody, I mean, you need to hear it. You need to actually hear it from the mouth of a person who deals with it. You mentioned earlier that a lot of doctors, because of their own fear of sexuality and other things, which is why they specialize in different areas, are reluctant to discuss it. my internist will not discuss any gynecological issues. He'd rather pull it up on the screen and see whatever my visit to my gynecologist revealed, which I think is sort of ridiculous. But and thank goodness you don't have to have a referral. But I think that, you know, once again, it's a communication issue as well. And I think Sherry would agree with me. It is a communication issue, but not necessarily just limited to communication between partners and communication between patients and doctors. I think that it's a societal miscommunication that people have a tendency to react to an issue as opposed to taking a proactive stance. Kegels certainly, I mean, there's no, you know, you can do Kegels at any age, but you don't. I don't think you necessarily have to wait until there's an issue to start doing them. And I think that people don't understand, because it's not communicated to them, that Kegels sort of fall into the category of prevention. And like you know, the three of us, I think we agree that up until this point, a lot of people think it's just an arbitrary exercise that has something to do with your physical appearance. But I think that I just think the point needs to be driven home more about the importance of doing that.
Yes, and I really think that we're missing the boat here by not creating that recognition. When women go in for, and this may sound extreme to you guys, but when they go into that first pelvic exam, if a brochure was given to them, and it just explained the basics of the pelvic floor and the purposes and its functions and what maintaining your pelvic floor muscle structure does to benefit you long term, you're not going to grab a woman who is 20 years old interest when you tell her that this is going to help you down the road after you have babies. It's going to prevent pelvic organ prolapse. But if you target the younger people and tell them it's going to have a huge impact to their sexual sensation, they're going to grab that and run with it. That pelvic floor muscle impacts many areas of our lives, and it's kind of a roll across the board there. It's not just one thing, it's many things. And so by creating that recognition early and establishing some kind of a baseline for how to do those Kegels, as you're saying, Dr. Porter, make women aware that if they, you know, wash your hands first, insert a finger or two fingers in your vagina, contract down like you do when you're going to stop that flow of pee, so you know what that sensation actually is, so you recognize it down the road, and then get on the Kegel bandwagon and know that this is like brushing your teeth. This is for life. You know, do it before you have babies, do it after you have babies. The stronger your pelvic floor is before you actually have children, before you actually give birth to babies, the faster your recoup time after, because you have healthy tissue down there. I mean, it impacts a lot of different things. As women get older, they get into menopause, and you don't have that estrogen impact to your muscle tissue anymore. Well, by having that Kegel sensation familiar to you and knowing what you need to do, well, if you start to lose the contractibility in your PC muscle, and you know it's okay to go to your doctor and say, okay, what's up here? You know, what's going on? Is this part of the menopause stuff? Is this something different? How do I handle it? Anything to stimulate that dialogue flow back and forth between that physician and that patient, and just creating the recognition in general is a good thing. It's always a good thing.
Yeah,
well,
I mean, and adding to that, I'm sorry, adding
ahead,
to that
ahead.
With, if you want to go. So adding the Kegels, what you can do, if you don't think you're doing them strong enough, you can get something called vaginal weights as well, which
right.
kind of forces you to do the right muscles, and they're called vaginal cones. There's a lot of good studies, especially out of Finland and Sweden, Dr. I think it's Carrie Bowe, B-O, and she has done a lot of work on that, and then somebody in the University of Alabama, Birmingham, has done a lot of work on the pelvic floor structures, and just using, if you can't figure out how to do Kegel properly, you can buy, you know, a very good set. I've used these for my patients. You can get them online pretty much anywhere. They're called set-free vaginal weights. I think they're usually like $59.95, but you can kind of get those, and it forces you to use the right muscles, and in order to keep the weight in, you have to contract the right muscles, or falls right on the ground. So that's another great kind of thing. If you can't figure them out, or your doctor is not willing, or you're unwilling to maybe approach your doctor, which you shouldn't be, you should be very open with your, you know, especially your gynecologist, to talk to him about it or her about it. But that's another very simple thing you can do at home, and just strengthen the pelvic floors. And like she was saying earlier, it's something that you have to commit yourself to. It's not the short-term fix. Just like, you know, if you don't get on that treadmill every day, you know, you can get out of shape. Same sort of thing, the pelvic floor. If you don't keep your pelvic floor in tone, you know, it's going to get out of shape as well. And it's great to do it before birth because it'll even make labor easier. It allows you to recover quicker, put less damage in the pelvic floor. Because the pelvic floor is essentially all muscle. That's all it is. It's a bowl of muscles, we tell patients. And there's a bones at the top, and there's all muscles in between. There's three holes, one for the urethra, one for the vagina, one for the rectum. And they're all interconnected. And if you lose support or some weakness, you know, you'll start compensating, and then your whole pelvic floor will be out of whack. Maybe you get some pelvic pain. So you need to keep those intact and strengthened and keep them strong to help prevent further problems and future problems as well.
Okay, so for all the men listening out there, because we hear all these public service announcements about, you know, on your anniversary, on this, why don't wait for an anniversary. Talk openly to your partner and encourage them to do Kegels. You know, it's funny. Women need a lot of emotional support. And a lot of things scare us that men would probably just blow off because they, for some reason, they always want to be the stoic ones. But when anything impacts a person, the way a person feels about themselves, and women who have, you know, pelvic organ prolapse, they don't always feel very good about themselves because they don't understand how they got to that place and how they're going to get out of that place, and they have a tendency to withdraw rather than investigate. And that's another reason that I did the show, because people need encouragement. Women need to be encouraged. They need to be informed of the importance of doing Kegels, but they also need to be encouraged to do it. And it's just like anything else, you know. The more support you have and the more encouragement you have, positive reinforcement you have, the better things go. Dr. Porter, I want to thank you for being on the show. Can you tell people how they can contact you?
I am in Charlotte, North Carolina, and our website would be Presbyterian Urogynecology. That's that kind of tells me about myself as well as services that we may offer. I'm part of the Presbyterian Hospital System, Novant Medical Group in the Charlotte area. Another good thing for patients is to kind of give some patient education. The American Urogynecologist Society will have it has a great patient website that will maybe it offers a local physician. They want to seek a local urogynecologist, people who have interest in the pelvic floor. That's a great website as well. Also has a lot of patient ed stuff. Talks about what prolapse is, what incontinence is, what you can do and help prevent that stuff. So that's a great resource for a lot of patients. And our society is trying to, you know, we're all about taking care of females. That's all we do. And the promotion of the pelvic floor health. And I think that's a great organization. And you can see a lot of information there just for patients themselves.
And Sherry, tell everybody what you do, well, who you are, what you do, and where people can find you.
Okay, Marcia. I'm Sherry Palm. I am a women's pelvic floor health advocate. My nonprofit can be found at pelvicorganprolapsesupport.org. For information about my book, I wrote Pelvic Organ Prolapse, The Silent Epidemic, and that information can be found at my personal website. That's sherrypalm.com. But I encourage women to go to the APOP site, the pelvicorganprolapsesupport.org site, because that's got a lot of basics, POP basics for women as well as a link to the OGS website, the urogynecologic website, too. So there's a link to the physical therapist women's health division there. There's a link to International Urogynecologist Society as well. So there's different directions women can go to from the library page to find information as well. So
I want to thank you both for being on the show, Sherry, especially for sending me that email, because that's what prompted the whole thing, and for Dr. Porter for making time to do this, because I think it's important You know, this season, we've had like at least 10 doctors on discussing different health issues, and a few of them were issues that affect women that men should know about, and this was certainly one. So I want to thank you both for being on the show. I want to thank you for educating and informing people instead of frightening them. And this is why a lot of people don't ask questions, because they're afraid. So when we do it in an open forum like this, no one has to be afraid, and they can get the information as well. So thank you both very much. Have a good summer. And Dr. Porter, I think I'm going to work with the person who helped me schedule you, so you can be on after we come back in the fall.
Okay, great. And just remember my great little saying I like to have, don't suffer in silence, and seek help if you really need it. That's kind of like the key point of what we believe in as women health advocates. I think that's what we need to all understand, and I think that's kind of the important part.
Thank you, Marcia, for bringing the subject to the table, too. That's hugely key in bringing the recognition out there, too, is the media paying attention to this topic.
I want to tell you both that after the show, this broadcast is available as a MP3 download on iTunes, so you are free to go there and use it any way you want to. Thanks again for being on, and have a good summer.
All right, appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Thanks. You, Marcia. Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay, so the purpose of Together Again is to get people in the know together with people who aren't in the know, and to clear up a lot of misconceptions that people have. Nobody functions very well sexually or otherwise when you don't feel good about yourself, when you feel like something is wrong or something doesn't look right, even if it doesn't hurt or anything like that. For some women, pelvic organ prolapse is just as disfiguring as if they had some kind of physical scar that was visible. But you don't have to suffer in silence. I mean, there are answers out there. There are people out there that can help you. The help doesn't have to cost an arm and a leg. Some of them are very simple, non-invasive cures, like the pessary for pelvic organ prolapse. Jim and I won't be here Monday because it's a holiday, and so we're going to enjoy our holiday, and we hope you enjoy yours too. We are going on hiatus June 9th, but if you have subjects that you would like us to discuss, please send them to me. You can email me at coaches@mdeanwalkerandassociates.com, or you can send me a message on Facebook at The Lady Marcia, and, you know, I try to schedule programs that people will on topics that people are really interested in. Sometimes, like any other talk show, we miss the boat, and sometimes I think we hit the mark. This has been a good season for us. Our listenership has increased substantially, due in large part to you, the people who listen to us on Mondays and Thursdays. And we are very appreciative of that. It makes a difference. We have tried to give platforms to almost anybody within reason who wanted to be on the show and we felt had something to contribute. This has been a very interesting season because it started off with the doctors and we went to small business help and we've talked about home loans and mortgages. And we've talked about all sorts of health issues because all of these things are what impact our relationships. People who are worried about health issues, about money issues, about communication issues, they don't have quality in their life. They have life, but it's not the kind of life they could have. And so, I try to make a difference, because it's important to me to make a difference. And Jim feels the same way. So you know where to find us. When we see you on the radio again, it will be June. It's hard to believe, but June is upon us. So have a very good and safe weekend. Have an amazing holiday. Hopefully no rain anywhere. And Jim and I will see you next Thursday on the radio.